Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with biographers about their work. This time, author and City University of New York scholar Jessica Mackstein talks about her biography, Funny Boy, the Richard Hunt biography, published by Rutgers University Press in March 2024. Jessica Mackstein was interviewed by fellow biographer and Bio member Brian J. Jones.
Hi, Max.
Hey, Brian.
Hey, so great to see you again. I'm going to start this off with the Brian Lamb Book Notes question and just ask you, who is Richard Hunt?
Richard Hunt was one of the five main performers with the Muppets. He is the animating force behind a lot of everybody's favorite characters from The Muppet Show, Sesame Street, Fraggle Rock. He's Scooter. He's Statler in the Balcony. He's Beaker. He's Janice. He's Sweetums in the full body suit. He's Junior Gorg. He's Don Music and a lot in Gladys the Cow. A lot of other characters on Sesame Street. And that's part of what drew me to the story, that his work was so iconic and then the life behind the work was so invisible.
Yeah, you've been working on this project in some form or another for a really long time. You had even like sort of like a short, almost like pamphlet, to use an old term for it, that I remember. And like Muppet fans loved even that, just even the small amount they were getting on it. You and I had talked to each other at a bio conference years ago, and I don't even remember how long ago it was. But let's talk a little bit about the sources you were using, because one of the things you and I talked about is when I was doing research on Jim Henson, there was a long interview with Richard in the Henson archive that you had not seen. And I don't even really know that you knew about it until you and I talked about it. So talk a little bit about the sources and the resources you had for this and writing about, you know, not just a figure that people is sort of behind the scenes with, but in a way, kind of a marginalized figure as well.
Well, I'm curious about your experience, though, because I don't know if you reached out to the Hensons about writing the biography, and then was there a period where they had to kind of think about that and get back to you?
Yeah, my experience was I had reached out to them and proposed the biography, but it took me about 2 years to, especially because there's a widow and five kids and kind of an organization behind it, to convince them to allow me to have access to the archives. Because as some people may or may not know, his archives are not publicly held any place. I think they may take care of that at some point, but his archives are not at University of Maryland or Connecticut. They're at their private company in Long Island. So I had to have their permission to be in there. So that was really key to me to writing that book. I wasn't going to write it unless I had that. But inside of those archives is where that interview was. But yeah, my experience was it did take quite a long time to get access.
Yeah. And so I had a similar, in some ways, different in other ways, experience, because Hunt, you know, is a less known figure. There is a lot less documentation. And so I had to go around and do a lot of interviews, gathering all of that information and getting all these different stories and different kind of versions of the story. So yeah, it started out as a zine in 2009. And that was basically me kind of collecting everything that was already out there about him and arranging it into a chronology.
Right.
And there was a great reception to that. I did a zine event at a bookstore, Blue Stockings in New York. I toured with it a little bit. People were just really excited about it and really excited to find out who he was. So that was sort of the first kind of nudge in my mind that, oh, this, you know, this might be a book. But then, so his mother, Jane Hunt, and his friend and coworker, Jerry Nelson, very, very early on were like, this is great that you're doing this. Let me tell you all kinds of wild, wonderful stories. And I just realized, you know, I couldn't invent a character that was this intriguing and that was this hilarious. And for a few months, actually, I went around just being like, oh, I would love to read this. I wish somebody would write this. God, somebody's really got to write this. Finally, one of my friends said to me, you know that somebody is you, right? And I was like, rats.
And so were you aware of the interview with Richard in the archives before I told you, or was that the first time you and I, was when you and I talked about it?
Yeah, the first time I heard about it from you. And so it just became part of my interviews, was just saying to people, you know, there's this interview in the Henson Archives. They were very nice.
Yeah.
But they basically just sent me like a bunch of obituaries.
Because I remember, because when you and I first started talking about it, I could not pass on materials that I have. And so I remember you and I had a long phone call where I was sort of trying to summarize, you know, this is what's in the document. And you were like, oh, my God. You know, and then at that point, I was almost sorry that I had done that to you, because you were like looking through the bars, you know, at something you couldn't quite get into. Yeah. I can't remember how we finally got you in there, but
I still am not really sure how that door opened. But I think this also points to bigger issues in biography, especially when there isn't a lot of documentation and you can't just go look in the archives.
Right.
It becomes very relational, you know, and especially somebody as beloved as Richard Hunt. And another thing that we're not mentioning is Richard Hunt passed away in the AIDS epidemic. He was only 40 when he died. And I think his friends were very protective of him.
Yeah.
Are you going to be telling the story with love and respect? Oh, you're not a puppeteer. Are you going to really understand what a genius he was in that field? And so the zine came out in 2009 and the book came out this year in 2024 in March. And a part of why it took that long, besides the fact that I was also, you know, working the whole time and not doing it full time, is that these sorts of things are relational.
Yeah.
You have to go out and get the story from people and then talk to even more people to verify the things you got from the first few people, you know,
right.
You really have to kind of climb that ladder of trust. Oh, okay. So his mother says that you're cool. And, you know, Jerry Nelson says that you're cool. And then, you know, they talk to a couple other people and you talk to them and then they talk to a couple other people.
So having to get access is already hard enough. And you and I both did it in sort of the same way and in different ways. One of the things I had to do was show them like I could do research. And similar to what you did with the zine, I had done some independent research and submitted them sort of a mock-up of a chapter. And there were things even in that chapter they had never seen. So they could see that I was approaching it that way. You were doing Richard's stories that way, but you also ran up against a bit of a wall because they were concerned about the gay narrative. And as a member of that community, did that make it harder for you or easier for you, do you think, to make your case?
Well, it wasn't one single united view on that. I think a lot of people had different views. I also think that that kind of thing just tells you more about the person who's talking to you than it tells you about you. And so I tend to just sort of let that stuff just kind of slide off your shoulders.
Right. You know? So the archival interview with Richard was obviously key. Did you come up with any other really great resources that you didn't know existed?
There are some wonderful stories in terms of interviews, but some of his friends had letters, which was really wonderful.
Oh, God, fantastic. Yeah.
So you really had his own voice.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about Richard with Jim Henson, because the stories are intertwined and Richard's a big part of Jim's story as well. But talk a little bit about his relationship, not just with Jim, but with Jim's family, because Jim really welcomed him in his memory. I got great stories from the Hensons as well on traveling with Richard and vacationing with Richard and how much fun the kids thought he was.
Well, he was also Uncle Richard to everybody's kids, to Henson's kids, to Martin Baker's kids. You know, a lot of times you wouldn't know where he was and he would just be off with the kids. Like, he was Uncle Richard. And Brian Henson said that what was great about him was that he would just kind of meet you where you were. So he met, I think Brian and John were like 13 and 11 around there, like early, very early teens. And there's this great quote in the book, like, sure, I'll march around with you and you can show me your swamp dwellings. And so they all went to Greece together while they were working on the Muppet Show. Richard went along with the family and they all took this boat tour of all these different islands. And he talked about that a lot in the interview, which was really funny. There was one point where he was looking at Henson swimming and he was like, oh my God, he even swims like Kermit. And I think you also can't separate both of their stories. And I got a lot of really nice feedback from Muppet fans that did really nice context of the whole story of the Muppets as a troupe, because puppetry is still kind of marginalized. And I think people didn't really understand that the Muppet Show could even get as big as it got. I mean, there's some nutty statistics. And at the height of its popularity, globally, it was being watched by more people than the population of the United States.
Right. And at one point, I think his producer, David Lazar, was claiming a viewership that was larger than the population of the planet, I think, at the time. So, but yeah, 235 countries, I think. Really incredible.
Yeah. You know, and I don't think anybody saw that coming. And so I think that sort of thing would have an effect on anybody's relationship, but especially when that person is your boss. And it's very tricky to talk about because, you know, Henson is obviously the mastermind of the Muppets. But one thing I really love about Henson is his eye to really pick out what he needs in the troupe. You know, like, for example, when Frank Oz joined, Henson was still perfecting his puppeteering. And so he had him teach him about that. You know, and then he brings in Dave Goltz, who is also a workshop person, who brings in his expertise about that. Henson didn't need to do everything himself. And so he created this fantastic troupe, all of whom were, I think, vital to the Muppets being so successful. And I worry that people look and they just think like, oh, Richard worked for Jim.
Right. I don't think people understand or appreciate how intimate puppetry can be. For example, Richard, one of his first jobs when he came in the door, and I think people need to know that Richard was one of the first big recruits Jim got when they were looking for new puppeteers on Sesame Street, recruited him. And Richard just came in the door, this fresh-faced teenager still, and just wowed them. Frank Oz called him a force of nature, saying like he wasn't necessarily the most technically proficient performer, but it was just so damn funny. But one of the first jobs Richard had was being the right-hander to Ernie. And to explain to people what that means is Ernie is a puppet that can use both hands. As a right-handed performer, Jim Henson would use his right hand in Ernie's mouth and then slide his left into Ernie's left hand. That left that right arm dangling. So Richard Hunt would put his right hand into the right hand of Ernie and operate that. And the way Richard himself would do it, and he talked about this, is he would actually loop his thumb through Jim's belt loop. So he knew when Jim was going to move. It's a very intimate thing, puppetry. And I think that goes to show the way those relationships are forged. I mean, you were literally, Frank Oz talked about living in someone's armpit for 30 years. You know, I mean, it's that kind of a relationship. Yeah.
Well, it's very intimate and it's also very physical. You know, mm-hmm. He got an ulcer, you know, puppeteers, they get hernias, they get this and that. Carpal tunnel, holding your arm up all the time, other things from that. I mean, it's hard on the body physically, but also, I don't know if you found this, but I definitely had like a wonderful learning curve in terms of learning about puppetry. And I knew that I had kind of come around the corner on the learning curve when I started getting irritated when people said to me, oh, he did the voices.
Did the voice.
I mean, it's so funny to imagine in the 50s on these like tiny little TV screens and you have people doing puppetry and they're using the puppet stage when they've already got the framing of the television set, you know? And so that was Henson's innovation. It's like, we don't need this puppet stage. The TV screen is the puppet stage.
Yeah, you've opened up that entire three-dimensional space, the puppets, yeah.
Yeah, but people don't realize how physical it is, how visual it is. Like I think about, do you remember, it's very early Muppet Show. It's either like Connie Francis or Julia Prowse, and it's and the Menomina guy, the do 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 do, and they're just playing the song together. Nobody talks, and it's so funny, just physically and visually, the two of them playing off of each other. I always tell people to watch that when they, oh, did he do the voices?
Yeah, it's so convincing, you know. And I've sort of ran into that in one of my other books writing about George Lucas, because you had Frank Oz performing Yoda. And when he was performing Yoda, they had to cut a hole in the floor. So Oz's space to perform was about 6 feet. And he said the director kept yelling that, you know, Yoda, go this way, move over. And Oz is under the floor going, I can't go anywhere else. You know, I'm stuck. And so it is great to sort of myth bust that, because you even still see today, oh, he's the voice of Miss Piggy. You know, they'll talk about Frank Oz, he's the voice of Yoda. Well, there's so much more than that. And like you said, puppeteering, it's you know, if I try to hang a light and I have my hands over my head for 4 minutes, I have to go lay down. I mean, my shoulders are just wrecked.
Yeah, very physical.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, Dave Goles, I think, just had hip replacement surgery from leaning over on one side to do Gonzo for 40 years in there. So in a way, you're trying to thread the needle when you're telling a story within a story. Was it challenging, frustrating at times to, you know, you're trying to tell a story of Richard's life and you've got to constantly bringing in context from another life while you're doing that?
I'm hearing kind of a couple different questions there.
Answer them all, Max.
Well, because I got this wonderful compliment from somebody who said that Funny Boy finds a unique story in the shadow of an often told tale. And that's what I love to do, because a good writer takes something that you've already seen and makes you see it differently. But that was sometimes one of the challenges of the book. You know, again, like, why aren't you telling a Henson-centric story? Like, whoa, you're talking about the Muppets. Oh, so you're going to tell me about Jim Henson. Well, I am, but I'm going to tell you about Jim Henson through the lens of the life of Richard Hunt. You know, I'm going to tell you about this person that you know, or maybe that you're curious about, through the perspective of this other person's life. And I enjoyed that.
One of the stories that I loved in the Jim Henson book, but I want you to talk a little bit about, again, that relationship with Jim and Richard. But, you know, Richard got into trouble at one point because he was publicly bad-mouthing someone who had been on The Muppet Show at one point, which is a big no-no, because Jim worked so hard to make people feel safe and at home. And he and his producer, David Lazor, decided they were going to read Richard the Riot Act. And David Lazor said, well, we're going to do bad cop. You know, I'm going to ball him out, then I'm going to turn him over to you. And they bring Richard in, who's still, I think, in his early 20s or mid 20s at that point. Yep. And David Lazor lets him have it. And he and Jim have these connected offices. And Richard's crying and very upset. And then Lazor says, no, you know, sorry, Richard, I got to turn you over to Jim. And Jim opens the door and comes running out and just wraps Richard in a bear hug. Just could not do it. I think partly it shows what kind of boss Jim was. But I think more than anything, too, it's because it was Richard. I think that relationship between the two of them is such a special one. It's different than so many of the other ones he has with some of his performers.
Yeah, and it's interesting to watch their relationship change as Richard grows over the course of his life, you know, because like you said, he joins the Muppets and he's like a hyperactive golden retriever puppy. You know, hey, here I am. Oh, I'm here. You know, this is great. And for a while, Henson is... It's a little reductive to call him a father figure, but Hunt lost his own father just as he began doing The Muppet Show. So it is kind of easy to sort of slip Henson into that role, whether it's Hunt doing that or it's us doing that, just sort of looking back on the story. And then I think both of them were really swept up when The Muppet Show was very successful. That really kind of sent everybody in a lot of different directions. You know, and then in the 80s, I really admired how, like, again, how Henson was really great at kind of finding the people to kind of execute his vision. You know, in the 80s, he starts really farming stuff out even more. And I say that without any, you know, any stigma at all, but just finds people that he trusts to do it.
Even something like Puppet Man, that was just a pilot, it didn't go anywhere. He puts Richard at kind of the, not quite the center, but off center in that, in a production like that even.
Yeah, absolutely. So they have a little more distance. But I feel like that distance combined with Hunt's rapid growth as a person throughout his 20s and 30s kind of enables him to grow up in Henson's eyes in a lot of ways. And then, so then by the 80s, he's trusting him. He's leading auditions before Henson even sees people who are auditioning. There's a great line in the book. Most performers who joined in this period recall Hunt as their first impression of the Muppets. And if that didn't scare them off, then nothing would. There you go.
That's right. Yeah, I love this. Somebody says, I might even have been Jim, or maybe it was Jerry Nelson. He said that you talked about him being an enthusiastic puppy. They said for the longest time, he'd be bouncing around. You'd have to say, Richard, get away. Go away, Richard. Go away. Go away.
Like a puppy.
Yeah, he was so enthusiastic and optimistic. And I remember even in reading something like Of Muppets and Men back in the 80s, it gave you an idea of how versatile he was. When people would come to visit the Muppet Studios there in Elstree, Richard would be the one who'd just throw any puppet on his arm and do almost any character, which again was, you know, not everybody could do that.
Yeah.
There's two other really important relationships in Richard's life that I call them in my SSU, the Nelsons. It's Jerry Nelson and then his boyfriend, Nelson. I think you're one of the sort of the first to ever really talk about Nelson.
I would love to talk about Nelson. I wanted to finish talking about how I just really love the way that Hunt and Henson's relationship changed as Hunt grew up and grew up so rapidly in such a short life. So he is doing the auditions. He's, you know, in charge of Little Muppet Monsters, this short-lived Saturday morning show in 1985. And he's really being trusted by Henson. He's emceeing the rap parties. There's a great little thing in there where a lot of people spoke about how he would often just speak for Henson. You know, they would get to the end of a show and Richard would be the one to stand up and to just be like, we had, you know, a great time here together, and really kind of bring everybody together and give them closure at the end of the Muppet Show. And so by the time Hunt started getting sick, he was much more present to people in general, a lot less kind of energetic. And they were more equal in each other's eyes. And so they were able to really sit together. There's a fantastic story from that interview that you and I were talking about, where he talks about telling Henson what's going on in his life spiritually, and also, you know, presumably in terms of his health. And they were able to really touch base. And he thought he was saying goodbye to Henson because he was sick. So then when Henson just died so suddenly, Richard said to a lot of his friends that he was just shocked because he thought he was going to go first. But I'm really glad that they were able to come together and kind of meet on a more equal and respectful and present footing. That whole arc throughout the book, I think, is really, really beautiful. It just shows growth in both of them, that not only that Hunt changed, but that Henson was present enough to see those changes. It's just really beautiful on both sides.
Well, and that's the word that I would have used, because I think it's very telling that Jim, in the letter he writes to his family years before his own death, but I think it's in 86, he writes a letter on how you will handle when he dies. I mean, he's very specific that it's Richard he wants emceeing that event. Yeah, that's how much he trusted Richard. And again, yeah, it does. It speaks to how much Richard grew up and how much Jim trusted in Richard and really knew he could rely on him.
Absolutely. But I actually asked around about that, if he's still around, line. Because there's a line in my book, it's hard not to look askance at that line.
I struggle with that line as well, too, Max, because he could have been saying, look, I'm planning to be a very old man, and Richard could also be a very old man, and many things can happen in a lifetime. I did ask several people about that line as well, and how much Jim knew at that time. And of course, the time I was doing that, people were only just speculating as well.
Well, I nailed it down, though, in terms of timing.
That right.
People didn't know that Hunt was sick, and that
right.
Like 98% not a reference to that.
Right. But did Jim know at that time in 86?
As far as I know, I'm pretty sure no.
No. Okay. So yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the two Nelsons, because you have the relationship, and I don't think anybody knew that story at all. I think you were the first one to tell the story of he and Nelson.
I'm just very careful when I tell this.
Sure.
Story. There's really not a lot that's around about him.
Yeah.
But he certainly was the person that Hunt loved most in the world, as far as we know. And it was Nelson's death that really was a catalyst for Richard to just kind of be more open about his identity. Because I also think it's easier to say, oh, I am gay. Like, that's a category. That's an adjective that maybe means something different to you than it does to the person that you're saying it to. And remember, he always wants to connect with everybody. He's never going to say something that is going to endanger a connection with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's people-pleasing to a certain extent. It's also just good socializing and connecting.
Right.
Point being, I think it's a lot easier to say, I love Nelson.
Yeah.
You know, I love this person, than it is to say, like, I have this identity. I am part of this community. It's a lot easier and just more straightforward, and you can still connect.
Right.
I mean, it's really tricky, though. He was a big compartmentalizer, too. So I have some people who were like, oh, he was never in the closet with anybody. No way. I'm not sure, you know, that's right in your book. And then I have other people who say exactly the opposite. So I, you know, I feel good that I maybe got it in the right balance. But Nelson was a big catalyst for him.
And I also always loved his relationship with the other Nelson, Jerry Nelson. And I got to tell you, Max, it tears me up. He didn't get to see your book come out.
He was so wonderful at the beginning. I mean, he was one of the first people to just tell me all kinds of just wild stories. But again, kind of connecting the two Nelsons, one of the very first things that Jerry Nelson said to me was like, we never talked about relationships. And I was like, great. Tell me about, you know, Biff and Sully. Tell me about Cape Cod. Tell me about, you know, how he always bought dinner for everybody. But again, it's that compartmentalization. You know, I mean, the two of them were so passionate about their work, and they were just so passionate about being performers, and they just, you know, just the kind of dedication to their artistry where you just both of them just doing it all the time. One time, Jerry more than once, I'm sure, rented the house just down the way from Richard's house in Truro. And they would like do characters to each other, just calling between the two houses, just in voices. And if you have that kind of shared passion for work with somebody, like, why would you talk about something that might be divisive? Wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
Near the end of his life, he was able to kind of lower those defenses in a way and be a lot more just present to people. I mean, Dave Gold said this wonderful thing in his memorial service, thank you for arriving before you left.
Oh, yeah. Lovely. I love that Dave said there were so many things about Richard that he didn't know about that he learned from your book as well.
Yeah.
And we're almost out of time here. And I just want to tell everybody listening, please go find Max's book. You know, even somebody who has lived in the Muppet world as much as I have and have written, there's so many great moments in there, so many great stories. And it is very hard to write about puppetry. And Max writes about it beautifully in her book. I want to ask you the question biographers hate, Max, but if there's like one thing you want people to take away from your book, what is it?
Well, you know, it's funny because I got this backhanded compliment about the book when I did a reading one time, because it was an older woman and she said, you know, I read about your book and, you know, I'm not really interested in the Muppets and I'm, you know, not really interested in the LGBT community and that, you know, in the epidemic. And so I just thought, well, okay, you know, but then I heard you read your book and I really thought you found the story in your book and that your book actually sounds interesting.
And thank you.
Right. Thank you, question mark. But I actually love that as a compliment. Yeah. Because I think that's the hardest thing to do, you know, and I read a lot of reviews and they're just, you know, well, first this thing happens in this book and then that thing. And I'm like, that's the content. Like, is there a story? Do you feel like the characters come alive? Like, how is this person actually like doing in terms of writing a book? You know, don't just tell me what's in the book. So one thing I would like them to take away is that it's a great story. It's the story of somebody trying to make the most of a really short life and doing so, I think, very well, very admirably, just connecting with a lot of people and doing fantastic work. I also love how many Muppet performers had very little interest in puppets, including Henson. And so to make the most of being a performer when people can't even see your face, I think that's a fantastic challenge that he really rose to.
Absolutely. It's been so great talking to you. It's been fun watching you on this journey. So I'm so happy for you and I'm so happy for Richard that you got this out there. So congratulations on the book and well done. And everyone, please read Funny Boy by Max Stein. You're going to love it.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking.
That was author Jessica Max Stein speaking with fellow biographer Brian J. Jones about her book, Funny Boy, The Richard Hunt Biography. It was published by Rutgers University Press in March 2024. We recorded this interview via Zoom on July 17th of this year. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Alani Hodge created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.